I'm really looking forward to today. When we first took on this series, I was really excited about a lot of things, and today is one of the lessons that I was most excited about. We're not going to spend very much time in Scripture today because we're really going to get to the practical side of things. We're going to get to evaluating where we are in our evangelism and how we can better reach our world today. Our communities, our neighborhoods, our contacts in town. And so as we look at this lesson this morning, I hope that we are ready to do what is necessary, but also we're excited about the possibilities. And so as we look at it, you can see under the first title, I have Changing Our Light Bulb. And so the joke goes, how many Baptists does it take to change a light bulb? Change. Baptists don't change, right? We don't like to change. And so that joke is out there. There's about a joke for every denomination out there when it comes to light bulbs. But the idea is, you know, we Baptists, we don't change. That is how we're perceived. That's oftentimes how we like to perceive ourselves, is that we're steadfast. But putting all joking aside, I believe that our light has gone out as a church, that although it flickers at times, as a whole, our light has gone out. And you might be thinking, Jordan, that sounds a little bit harsh. To which I would point us to the baptismal, which you can't see right now because it's covered up. But I want you to think in your minds, when was the last time we used the baptismal? When was the last time we saw somebody come to Christ and baptized? And it's been a long time. I know it's been before I got here. And to me, that's a very real way of really measuring the temperature of our church, measuring our success, our light in the community. And so as we look at this, I truly believe that the health of a church is measured by the frequent, consistent use of its baptismal. Now, you might say, well, if they're not Baptist, they might not have a baptismal, which I would say, okay, yes, true. But we would probably have other issues with that. But as far as churches that we would partner with, you can see the health of a church by how often they use their baptismal. How often are new converts coming to Christ? How often are they getting the opportunity to share Jesus Christ with those that are around them? And so today we're gonna talk about this. We're gonna talk about the idea of how do we get our light back? How do we truly become a light in this community? And Alvin Reed, I talked about him last week a little bit. It says talking about different churches that he's seen. He says that two indispensable ingredients for any stagnant church to be growing. First, you must want to grow, which I truly believe that most of you want to grow, if not all of you want to grow. And I think our church really does want to grow. You know, when we hear people praying or prayer requests or different things, we talk about our church growing, and we really want our church to grow. But the second piece of this, he said, you must be willing to pay the price to grow, to which he adds, sadly, many do not. And we're going to talk about that price today. We're going to talk about what does it truly take to grow. If we want Bethany Bible Church to grow and become a healthy church that regains its light, we must be willing to pay the price to grow. This means evangelism must be central. It must be one of the pillars that we are pushing forward as a church. We cannot be content to hold the fort on non-essential issues while those outside are lost, dying, spending an eternity in hell, separated from God forever. And I'm not calling for huge, drastic changes in our church. We'll get to the change that I'm talking about and what exactly I mean by holding the fort. But I was reading in a book, and I think this illustration really brings home what I'm trying to communicate. And this is probably one of the most sobering illustrations I've read as I've read different stuff on evangelism. And so as I read through it, it is, for a lot of you, it's going to bring up a lot more memories than me. And it'll probably even build on your emotions as well. But I want to take from this illustration and I want to learn from it. And so this is a man that is going to be giving his story of what it was like in Germany for him during the Holocaust and everything that was going on. He says, I lived in Germany during the Nazi Holocaust. I considered myself a Christian. I attended church since I was a small boy. We had heard the stories of what was happening to the Jews, but like most people today in this country, talking about America, we tried to distance ourselves from the reality of what was really taking place. What could anyone do to stop it? A railroad track ran behind our small church, and each Sunday morning, we would hear the whistle from a distance, and then the clacking of the wheels moving over the track. We became disturbed when one Sunday we noticed cries coming from the train as it passed by. We grimly realized that the train was carrying Jews. They were like cattle in those cars. Week after week, that train whistle would blow. We would dread to hear the sound of those old wheels because we knew that the Jews would begin to cry out to us as they passed our church. It was so terribly disturbing. We could do nothing to help those poor, miserable people, yet their screams tormented us. We knew exactly what time that whistle would blow, and we decided the only way to keep from being so disturbed by the cries was to start singing our hymns. By the time that train came rumbling past the churchyard, we were singing at the top of our voices. If some of the screams reached our ears, we'd sing a little bit louder until we could hear them no more. Years have passed, and no one talks about it much anymore, but I still hear the train whistle in my sleep. I can still hear them crying out for help. God, forgive us, all of us who called ourselves Christians yet did nothing to intervene. Now, so many years later, I see it happening all over again in America. God forgive you as Americans, for you have blocked out the screams of millions of your own children. The Holocaust is here. The response is the same as it was in my country. Silence. And Alvin Reed comments by saying this. Wal Lee, the name of the guy, applied this tragic story to the abortion Holocaust in America. It also speaks to the negligence of the church to seek to save lost souls from hell. May our generation not be so busy spending time in activities at local church buildings that we miss the cries of the hurting. And I don't know about you, but that really hit home for me. That really saddened me, because that story, the story of, you know, hundreds, maybe even thousands over time of Jews traveling past this church, crying out, and instead of doing something about it, they sang louder and louder until they drowned out the cries. And there are unsaved all around us today. There are unsaved in our neighborhood. There are unsaved all over Hendersonville. And we can do one of two things. We can try to go out and reach them, or we can come to our church. We can be comfortable, and we can sing louder and louder until we have soothed our consciences and we have drowned out the cries of those who are dying and lost in their sins. And so what do I mean by holding the fort? Well, I believe that the heartbeat of everything we do around here should be the gospel. The lion's share of our singing should be centered around the Lamb who was slain. And Revelation chapter 5 and verse 9 talks about this. When we get to heaven, that we'll be singing, the angels will be singing, everybody will be rejoicing over the Lamb who was slain. And I'm not saying that we don't sing in adoration to our Father or about his mercy, grace, love, and grandeur. But if our song for eternity will in fact be of the surpassing worth of the Lamb who was slain, that it would only make sense that we focus the majority of our songs on this precious truth as well. The vast majority of what we should do and what we should be doing as a church should be centered around equipping, encouraging, and practicing evangelism. In order to be a growing, healthy church, we must be willing not only to say we want to change, but also willing to pay the price of that change, especially when it comes to the mission of the church. An evangelistic church is one that is willing to pay the price, willing to experience the pain that it takes to reach people. Enrico Tice, in his book, Honest Evangelism, put it this way, and I think it's really good. He says, so if you are going to talk to people about Jesus, you're going to get hurt. It is going to sever some relationships. It is going to provoke people. Not every time, and depending on our circumstances, friendships, groups, workplaces, and so on, our experiences will vary, but we will face rejection enough of the time to give us second thoughts. Because I don't know about you, but I don't particularly like getting hurt. We're wired to assume that if we're getting hit, something's gone wrong. And so whenever I tell someone the gospel message and get hit, metaphorically speaking, there's a temptation either to stop saying anything or to change what I'm saying. I know there's a pain line that needs to be crossed if I tell someone the gospel, but I want to stay on the comfortable side of the pain line. Of course I do. And I think all of us would say that too. We want to be on the comfort side. We don't want to feel like we're getting hit for our witness. We don't feel like we want to offend people. You know, this week I was out and I was in our neighborhood and I was talking to several people and just seeing what they thought about our church, seeing where they went to church and stuff like that, and just trying to have conversations with people. And I talked to one guy who was walking his dog, And I just started asking him some questions, what he thought about our church. And he said, well, I moved here about 2.5 years ago, and I've never actually been to your church. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. He's like, but I go to Mud Creek Baptist. I was like, okay. He's like, but yesterday, and this would have been Thanksgiving the day before, he said, yesterday, I actually was at the Catholic Church for Mass, because my wife used to be Catholic. And to him, there's no difference between Catholicism and Mud Creek Baptist. That was the same thing in his mind. Religion is religion. And I didn't get a chance to, you know, share every distinction between Catholicism, between Baptist and everything like that. But it really opened my eyes to the idea that if somebody is going to reach this person, they're going to have to go through that. And inevitably, the response may just be that he doesn't like the idea that we're trying to distinguish between the two. And oftentimes, we don't like to distinguish things. We like to just kind of nod our heads and say, interesting, okay, that's cool. And I know that's where I find myself oftentimes, because I don't like to cross this pain line. But later on in the same book, Tice says, we must be honest about the hostility and we'll have wrong expectations and give up on evangelism. But we must also be excited about the hunger, and we'll have no expectations at all and never start evangelism. And so what he's saying is, we can either be honest about it and scared of it and we'll never do it, or we can be really excited about it but have no expectations that God is actually going to do something and we'll never start it. He's saying there's a pain line that needs to be crossed. But before we go jumping into changing everything, let's evaluate where we are. I don't want to just come in and change everything. I've seen it done before in churches where pastors come in and they change everything, and it doesn't go well. It doesn't go well to just change everything. And in fact, oftentimes it hurts. And you know, I was recently in a CPR class up at the Wilds, and we talked about before you go in and start performing CPR or whatever first aid procedure, you need to size up the scene. And I don't know if you've ever been in a CPR class, but it's like the one thing that just gets repeated over and over and over and over again. And so like inevitably the instructor will ask you, okay, this is the scenario that you run across. What's the first thing that you do? And your first thought is, okay, perform CPR or stop the bleeding or whatever it is. And it's always wrong, because the first thing you always do is size up the scene. Because you don't want to start CPR on somebody that has, you know, a big wound that when you start doing CPR and start pumping the blood through the heart, you're just pumping it out a hole that's already been created. And in essence, you're ruining your chance of saving a life because you didn't size up the scene. You didn't appropriately figure out what the situation was. So that's what I want to do today. Is one of the things I want us to accomplish is I want us to do kind of an inventory of where we are, to check our pulse, so to speak. So we're going to be looking at evaluating in three different categories. So I want us to do this together. And some of you may not have writing utensils, but I have some boxes that I would like you to fill in, and you can share if you don't have a writing utensil. But the first area, and we're looking at strengths and weaknesses. And so what I would like you to do is put either a plus or a minus in these boxes in these three categories. The first one is being motivated. It's the idea that you genuinely want to share Jesus Christ with the people that are lost in sin around you. So this is somebody that looks, they see people that are lost, and they say, I want those lost people to have the gospel. I want these people to be saved. And believe it or not, there's people that aren't motivated in that way. They're not motivated for the lost world around them to be saved. They're content to just live their private, personal Christian life. And so, motivated. Are we properly motivated? Plus or minus in that box for where you are personally. The second thing is being available, and that is having significant interactions with unsaved people. Being available means that you know unsaved people, that you make yourself available to unsaved people. It means that you are out in the community, that you are engaged with your neighbors. You know who they are. You've had conversations with them. You're trying to get to know them better. So available. Are you available? So plus or minus in that box as well. And then thirdly, equipped. I can effectively communicate the gospel. There's a lot of people that are terrified of sharing the gospel, but are equipped. And there's a lot of people that are just not equipped to share the gospel. They've never really learned how to share the gospel well or clearly communicate what they believe. And so for you personally, would you put a plus mark or minus mark in that box? Are you equipped? Could you have a gospel conversation if the door was open for that. If somebody came and asked you to share your faith, share what you believe, would you be able to do that? And that's what that one means right there. And so I want us to take these, and I want us to look at this chart. The first category, and this is just, and I got all these, by the way, from a man named Max Stiles, and I think this is very helpful to understand where we are. The first one is all minuses. You are neither motivated, available, or equipped. And he says that you were sequestered. And then the third one is that you're not motivated. You're available. You know the outside world. You have a lot of contacts that are unsaved, but you're also not equipped. And he would say that you are apathetic. And I would agree with him. The third category is academic. This is somebody that's not motivated to reach the lost, doesn't have unsaved contacts, doesn't have any interaction with lost people, but is very equipped to give the gospel. They know the ins and out, and that person would be an academic. The fourth category, I guess, is somebody that is motivated. They definitely want to reach the lost, but they don't know lost people. And not only do they not know lost people, but they wouldn't even know how to share the gospel if they met them. And this person is a frustrated person. This person is frustrated in their evangelism. The next category is somebody that's not motivated, but has the contacts and is equipped to give the gospel. And that person would be daunted. And then the isolated person is somebody that is motivated and equipped, but not available. They're somebody that has everything they need except for the person to share the gospel with. Reckless is somebody that is motivated, available, but not equipped. And usually these would tend to be new believers. Somebody that is very recently saved, that is very motivated to see their lost friends, their lost contacts come to Christ. And they're definitely available because they have those contacts, but they don't have the training. They don't really know how to clearly communicate the gospel. And oftentimes this does turn into recklessness. And then the last category is what we're going for, and that is an engaged Christian. Somebody that is engaged in evangelism. And so in that blank, I would write down what you are out of all these categories. And I will let you know right now that I'm very motivated for evangelism. I believe that I have been very well equipped with different things that I've been taught and learned over the years. But I'm not available. And it frustrates me that I'm not available. But I definitely see in my own life how I'm isolated, how I don't know very many unsaved people. And I'm trying to do what I can to change that. But it is difficult. It is difficult to change a weakness to a strength. And I know that is true in my own life. And so as we go through these different diagnoses, it has a lot of helpful things here in this chart. And so I'm going to go through some of these. I would assume that most of you wouldn't belong in the first one with all the weaknesses. But this is somebody that's not interested. Their faith is adopted rather than personal. They're a cultural Christian, and we see so many of these. You know, as we walk around, as we talk to people, everybody goes to church. You know, we're in the Bible Belt. Even if they don't actually go, they claim they go to a church. And these are cultural Christians. I don't think you can find any more cultural Christians than are located here in the Bible Belt of America. They have marginalized Christian lives, and what they need is they need to make a commitment of faith apart from the Christian subculture. And then secondly, the apathetic. They say, my religion is a personal thing, like I was talking about earlier. They're sleeping giant of the church, no functional difference from non-Christians in the workday world. They have no testimony of Christ because they don't really want to be bold, to cross that pain line. And so they look like just any other person because their light isn't shining brightly. And then they're a churchgoer. They don't see that evangelism is important. And there's some assimilation by the secular culture. And we should embrace them, but they need to embrace their faith. And they need to come to know Christ's love for others. They need to look at what the Bible says about sharing Christ. And then there's the frustrated. And maybe this is where you are today. They're confused by what to say and who to say it to. They have a heart to share Christ. They really want people to come to know Christ. And these are many church members. They have debilitating guilt, which means they're afraid of sharing the gospel, but they're also, they feel like they can't because They haven't been properly equipped. And so they need to look for a mature Christian role model, learn a biblical approach to evangelism, and build bridges to the secular culture. And so as you look through these, we could read through all of them, and I won't take the time to read through all of them because you have them right there in front of you. But these are different levels of where your evangelism is. And for some of you, it might be the engaged, and I know it is. You're giving away your faith. You're sharing the gospel effectively using a biblical approach. You're available to people who do not know Christ. You're motivated by love. And the type of person that this is all types. And that is what Max Stiles says, and I believe that to be true. Oftentimes, we think the only people that are really good evangelists are the people that are extroverts and that are really good at talking. But that's not really what it's all about. It's about being motivated, being available, and being equipped. And those are three things that all of us can do. And we'll continue on in this lesson, but we're going to hit on that idea all throughout the lesson. We're going to be looking at the fact that, you know, you don't need to be a certain cut of Christian, a certain cut of a personality to be an evangelist. So, are you willing to pay the price to obey the command of Christ to go and make disciples? Having just talked about the isolated, let me explain what I've been building this lesson towards and really what our whole evangelism series is about. And some of you have probably caught this by now, but we are not ramping up to introduce this huge new evangelism program in our church. And so we're not going to be, you know, at the end of this evangelism series, talking about this huge explosion of evangelism that we're going to be doing as a church body on, you know, these different nights a week. That's not really what we're looking at today. We're not looking for a new program to run here at Bethany. And the second half of my lesson is not going to introduce that. Instead, it's going to talk about a different way of viewing evangelism. Max Stiles says, something you should do in evangelism might not be the best thing for the church to do as a whole. Kevin DeYoung, in his book, What is the Mission of the Church?, says, don't make the church body do everything you want the body parts to be doing. Instead, we have been aiming at the mindset of evangelism. And that's what we're getting at, is there needs to be a mindset in our church of evangelism. So let me give you a couple of examples of what I'm not talking about, a couple of examples of programs, and these are taken from Max Stiles' book on evangelism, speaking of different programs that he's seen. He says, here's an example of what I mean. Pastor Jackie is a friend of mine who works with a Chinese-speaking church in Dubai. He's done amazing work among the poor Chinese who come to the city as laborers. One year around Christmas, some good-hearted Westerners had the idea to distribute shoeboxes to the laborers. There's certainly nothing wrong with that. So families in Dubai churches put soap and washcloths, some cologne combs, and a couple of other personal grooming items, along with some small items of clothing, into a shoebox. They also put flyers for the church services and wrapped up boxes with Christmas bows. Again, no problem. Then people were recruited to collect the boxes, and here's the kicker. Deliver them to Jackie. I remember dropping by Jackie's office and not being able to get in the door because of all the shoeboxes. Floor-to-ceiling shoeboxes. Put aside questions about the biblical basis for the outreach or how effective it was. Put aside questions concerning the long-term good or even what statement was being made by rich Westerners giving grooming items to poor laborers. The root issue was that Jackie could not prepare a sermon. He could not meet with his people who wanted to talk with him about Jesus. He could not fulfill his ministry and equip the church members for theirs because people did not understand that it was his role, their role to reach out, and Jackie's role to preach, shepherd, and pray for the flock. The people mistook their role in the church for the role of the church. Let's say the shoebox ministry did the best thing possible and people came to the Chinese church. When they did, what kind of church would you hope they encounter? A healthy church, where they heard the gospel and the preaching of the word, where members were discipled and were on game in evangelism, where the gospel was presented in baptism, the Lord's Supper, and more. Or a sick church, where leaders spent all their time delivering shoeboxes. If Jackie were to spend all his time delivering shoeboxes and not attending to the work given to him to nurture a healthy church, he would be letting the church lie fallow. This is true not just of Jackie, but of any elder of any church. Members are free to do many other things, but they must be very careful to support the leadership so that the church goes in the right direction. The well-meaning believers in Dubai did not distinguish between the church's responsibility and their own. They believe the church should reach out to the laborers in the same way they wanted to reach out personally. But by acting on this assumption, they actually subverted the church. And what I'm not saying is that you can't go talk to Pastor Bond about your burdens and what you would like to see the church doing. He would love to do that anytime. His door's open. But we have to be very careful about putting our burdens on the church as a whole. But because just because you want to reach a certain people doesn't mean that the whole goal of the church is to reach this people. But it could be a goal of a part of the church to reach that people. And it probably is. That's why you've been given that burden. And so a second example from the same book. He says, recently I was at High Point Baptist Church in Austin, Texas. The pastor, Juan, had asked me to do a seminar on developing a culture of evangelism. I talked and people asked questions. Then someone asked an elephant in the room type of question. Many Vietnamese are moving into the community around our church. What is the church going to do to reach out to them? On the one hand, this was a wonderful question. A member had recognized that she had the privilege and responsibility to reach out with the gospel, and she saw an opportunity to do it. On the other hand, the way the question was phrased seemed to imply that reaching out was the responsibility of the church, not the person who had noticed the opportunity. But a culture of evangelism is grassroots, not top-down. In a culture of evangelism, people understand that the main task of the church is to be the church. We've already seen the church practices are a witness in and of themselves. Certainly, the church supports and prays for outreach and evangelistic opportunities. But the church's role is not to run programs. The church should cultivate a culture of evangelism. The members are sent out from the church to do evangelism. I know this may seem a bit picky, but it's really important. If you don't get this right, you can subvert the church or be wrongly angry with your church leadership. Here's how I responded to the question at High Point. It's really not the best thing for the church to set up a program for Vietnamese outreach, but rather for you to think how you can reach out. I would recommend you learn some about the Vietnamese culture, maybe by learning some greetings in Vietnamese, trying their food, and learning about the struggles they face living in the majority culture. Reach out and invite the friends you make to come with you to your home, a small group Bible study, or church. Then perhaps some of you should even think of moving into the Vietnamese community with the purpose of commending the gospel among the community. I was met with blank stares, but there was great relief on the face of Pastor Juan, who was grateful I had not just single-handedly set up an outreach program for him to run. Then I added, and when you bring your friends from the community into church, everyone is on game. You are all reaching out. That's a culture of evangelism. It's not just about being friendly, though this needs to happen, but having a deep awareness that we are in this together. In a healthy church, visitors see the gospel present in all we do. That's why we sing the word, pray the word, preach the word. We want people to hear the gospel in the service, and we want to practice the sacraments. We want them to see the gospel and hear it again as we explain what's happened. As members live out the gospel comes out of us. That's a sketch of a culture of evangelism at work. I know it's a bit radical, and I didn't even suggest they enroll their kids in the local school with the Vietnamese kids. Some might accuse me of not caring for the Vietnamese community because I told High Point not to set up a church-sponsored outreach. But I would argue that the best way to care for the community, or any community, is to give them the gospel so they can come to faith. The goal is best served by the witness of a church that has a culture of evangelism, by members making friends with Vietnamese people with whom they can share the gospel. This approach has a far greater impact than a church program for clothing distribution, daycare, going door-to-door, bringing in a kiddie carnival, or any other various good-hearted things churches do. And right off the bat, some of you may be thinking, well, we just had these family fun nights. And yes, we did, didn't we? And you might be thinking, well, hey, he just said we're not about programs, but then he's talking about a program. And I will say this, and actually I'll read a quote from the same book that I've been reading about. He says, programs are like sugar. It's tasty, even addicting. However, it takes away a desire for more healthy food. Though it provides a quick burst of energy, over time it makes you flabby, and a steady diet will kill you. How many of you love candy corn? All the teens raise their hand, right? And thank you, Jonathan. Jonathan raised his hand too. I love the candy pumpkins. And in my house, that's become kind of a thing that nobody's allowed to touch the pumpkins except for me. But a steady diet of candy pumpkins will make me look like a candy pumpkin. It's not good for me. However, a few candy pumpkins here or there, which to say a few would be a bit of a stretch for me, but a few of them here or there is not going to hurt you. In fact, some would argue that it might be a little bit good for you, at least your spirits. But if you only eat a diet of sugar, it makes you really unhealthy. But a little bit here and there, yes, it does give you a burst of energy, and you can build off of that energy, but you will crash if that's all you eat. And so it's okay to eat sugar once in a while, and in the same way, it's okay to have evangelistic programs once in a while, here and there, to be used strategically. Alvin Reese says this: it is much easier to invite a person to an event at a church or to go on a weekly visitation than to spend the time needed to cultivate relationships with lost people to see God work in their lives. And I don't know how many visitors exactly were at the family fun night, and I don't want to say every visitor because I don't know for sure all the visitors and how they got invited, but I know that a bunch of the visitors that we did have came from relationships that were already built, came from people that had already done the work to build a relationship with them, so that when they invited them, there was a friendship that had already been formed, and they respected that friendship and said yes. And they came, they heard the gospel, and not only that, but as they go home, they have that connection to this church member as well. They still have that relationship. And so studies say that an average of 2 years from when people come in contact with a Christian who shares the gospel with them, will they actually put their faith in Christ. That's an average of 2 years. That's a long time. 2 years of a program would kill this church. If we continue every week to run a program, and after two years we finally see somebody come to Christ, well, we probably won't have very many people in the church at that point, because programs take a lot to keep running. But if we go out and we make friends with people that are unsaved, and over years we continue to be a light and a testimony, then over time we have that opportunity to see them come to Christ. Other statistics say that an average of 7.6 times are heard of the gospel before somebody commits their life to Christ. Rico Tice says, witnessing is a long-term commitment to invest in a relationship, to pray tirelessly, and to speak the gospel over and over again, patiently and persistently. It is a journey of gospel conversations. And I'm going to call this journey of gospel conversations conversational evangelism. And this isn't a term that is, you know, something I, you know, thought of in a Starbucks or anything like that. It is a term that is used, and there are different terms for it, and there are different faults with this system, or any system for that matter. But I'd like to point out some of the strengths and some of the things that we should look out to avoid as well. But first of all, conversational evangelism is about making connections, not projects. It is so important how we see people. You know, people know when you want something from them rather than just care about who they are. You know, when I walk up to my dad and I start a conversation, he usually knows if I just am trying to get something out of him. And we must learn to see individuals as people. Friends, sinners, neighbors that Christ died for. As potential brothers and sisters in Christ, not as projects. Conversational evangelism allows you to talk to others about Christ out of your own strengths. You know, we have to care about people. Part of our motivation has to be their soul. It isn't just, you know, we need more people in the church, and this is a person that could possibly come to church, so they're my project, so I can fill our church pews. It has to come out of a deep love for them, a deep love for seeing the lost come to Christ. And ultimately, that love comes from the fact that Jesus Christ loved them so much that he would give his life for them. Jason Gaston says, do what you do well for the glory of God, strategically for the mission of God. And I really love that. You know, it isn't about doing something you don't know how to do well. It isn't about us all doing the same things well. It's about all of us doing what we do, doing what we enjoy to do, doing what we're good at doing, and using that strategically for God's mission. You know, I've read countless stories as I've read different evangelism books and articles and all of this different stuff. And it's always like, so amazing to me the different things that people figure out to use as a bridge to evangelism. And in some ways, like it amazes me that something, you know, so trivial oftentimes, and so something that we enjoy so much could be used as a bridge to the gospel. And yet, you know, we have different talents here in this church. We have a body that is diverse. We have some people that are very active in music. We have other people that are very good at quilting. We have other people that are good at a numerous amount of things. But it's using those different things and taking those talents and those, you know, desirous things that we do, those hobbies that we love to do, and learning how to use them to reach lost people. Because you're probably not the only one that loves doing what you do in this community. You can probably find other people that love doing that with you and building a relationship that way. And it's not about every time you meet with somebody, every time that, you know, you share a meal, or every time that you spend time doing a project with somebody, you have to share the gospel with them. We share the gospel strategically. You know, we know people that when we share the gospel every single time with them, they will be turned off to the gospel. Oftentimes, what we need to do is we need to be strategic. Not every time you sit across the table with somebody do you need to bring up every single point of everything you've ever learned about the Bible and about God. But we need to use those conversations. We can't just be content on the other side of the spectrum to say, you know, I'll just let my walk do the talking. No, we need to talk about Jesus Christ, but doing it strategically. And there's people that have different theories. I know of a guy that I read about that said, one out of every five conversations that I have with a coworker, I bring up God and I bring up the gospel. And whatever it is for you, you don't have to force the gospel every single time, but you need to be willing to walk through different doors that are presented to you. And so most of us and most of people that will be won for Christ will be won because they see our passion for Christ and not our knowledge of Christ. People want to see Jesus lived out, not just talked about. The unsaved are attracted to Christians who are passionate about living out what we say we believe. So conversation evangelism is caring about two things: caring about the unsaved individual and caring about the gospel. We must be careful that we view people as individuals and love them as people. It goes a long way in the fact that if we show that we care about people, they're a lot more likely to listen to us, and they want to know why we care about them, especially in a world that is so shallow and so caught up in what they want to do. When we genuinely care about people, people want to listen. They want to know why. But the second thing is we have to care about the gospel, and we have to care about communicating it clearly and in a way that is appropriate. But I will say this, and this is using a phrase that Zach Sparkman would use on us all the time at the Wilds, and he would say, energy is caught, not taught. And in the same way, evangelism is oftentimes caught, not taught. And what I mean by that is oftentimes on a Friday morning, a Thursday morning, it'd be raining, and we would be having our meeting, and none of us really want to be up at 6:45 in the morning at this meeting with Zach Sparkman. And he looks at us and he says, we have a game this morning, and if you want our campers to win this game, you have to know that your energy is what they're going to feed off. And so we would all take off our rain jackets. We would all, you know, we would get out there and we would bring energy, not because we wanted to, because if we're being honest, none of us wanted to walk out into the rain, but we'd bring energy because we knew that the campers would feed off of our energy. And in the same way, our evangelism is caught, not taught. As people in the church begin to do it, other people will catch on and they will get excited about what's happening. Reed says, don't settle for show up to church, give some money, and serve at the building approach to Christianity that has left so many unchallenged and apathetic. Push yourself to grow and learn. You were born for this. And we talked about this, the fact that we were reconciled and given the ministry of reconciliation. Now we are ambassadors of Christ. This is what he's talking about. We were born. We were made to be a Christian that shares our faith. And we talked about it last week as well when we talked about stagnating and the idea of the Dead Sea and everything flows in it, but nothing lives in it because it has no outlet. And so it stagnates. So as Christians, if we want to grow, one of the best ways to grow is to find somebody to share the gospel with, to let what we know come out of us and we begin to grow as Christians. The Lord wants us to be faithful in our own way, in our own world. The greatest benefit is that it enables us to meet people where they are at, both geographically and spiritually, rather than expecting them to come where we are. You know, oftentimes we want to see people come to church, and when people come in the church building, then we'll evangelize. But we got to learn to meet people where they are, care about who they are, and share about the God that we love and that we serve. And so the next thing is learning to ask good questions. And if you look here, it says Mr. Nick Maurer. That's because I took his notes and I copied and I pasted them in. The reason being is because I knew I wouldn't have time for it. And so I wanted to give them to you because it's very interesting as you look through this. And he talks about questions building knowledge and the fact that asking questions shows that we care about them. And asking questions is how we learn from them. And I think point two is very good, earning conversation capital. And what he talks about is the fact that when we put into the bank, then we can withdraw. But oftentimes, we try to withdraw before we've really invested in people. And Steve Pettit talked about that a lot. For us in our roles in student life at Bob Jones, he would talk about the fact that we need to be investing in students because at some point, we're probably going to need to make a withdrawal. And we want to have invested enough in their lives that we can make that withdrawal, whatever that withdrawal is. And I saw that over and over again. When I took time to get to know people, to spend time with them, to really care about them, those are the people that when I had to correct them for something or I saw something in their lives that I wanted to talk to them about, I felt comfortable going and talking to them about. And the reason being is because I spent that time investing in their lives. But oftentimes what would happen is there's a student that's way down in the hall that kind of keeps to himself, I haven't spent a ton of time with, maybe I did one meal with him all semester, and he gets into trouble. And then I had to be the one that would walk into his room and confront him about it and talk to him about it, and it's really awkward because I know I haven't spent the time investing. And here I am, stepping into his room, trying to make a withdrawal, but I haven't spent that time investing. And in the same way, we have that opportunity with unsafe people. When we invest, when we spend the time to talk to them, to get to know them, to care about them as a person, then when they say something, like what I heard the other day in the neighborhood about going to both a Baptist church and going to the Catholic Mass, and there's no problem there, you know, I didn't have that investment that I've made in his life to make that withdrawal to say, hey, let's talk about this a little bit, because I haven't gotten to know him. I just met him on the street. And so I didn't feel comfortable making that withdrawal at that point because I haven't spent that time investing. But you have the opportunity with your neighbors, with your connections in town, you have the opportunity to make that withdrawal if you've invested. And it takes a lot to invest in people. It's going to cost us something. Like we said, if we want to change, it's going to cost us something. And oftentimes it costs us our time. But then at the end of this lesson, I have what I said was a question bank. These are a lot of questions, well, a few questions, I guess, that I've put together that I've read that are very good questions to getting to what people believe and sharing the gospel with them. And this is just a sampling of different questions I've run across. There are so many different questions, and every situation calls for its own question. I'm not saying you run down this list of questions with everybody or anybody for that matter, because all these different questions are for different scenarios, and all of them apply to different people where they're at. So asking somebody, maybe your neighbor, maybe a connection in town, saying, when you attend church, where do you attend? You know, that's putting it in a very positive way. If you ask them, do you go to church? Then you've put them kind of on the defensive, because if they don't go to church, you've kind of put them out. But when you ask a question like, when you attend church, where do you attend? You give them the opportunity to be the one that says, I attend this church, or oftentimes they'll just say, you know, I actually don't attend church. But the way that you put it assumes the best out of them. And that's the way that they'll see it. Another question that you can ask is, do you ever think about spiritual things? You know, this is a question you're not going to ask everybody or just somebody you meet on the street. Do you ever think about spiritual things? But this is a question that can get the ball rolling for you if you don't know how to transition things into something spiritual. Or you have, in your opinion, what is a real Christian? Or what do you think of Jesus, God, the Bible? These are different questions that you can ask. And again, it comes from a lot of times out of a relationship that you've built. Who do you think Jesus Christ was? Have you come to a place in your life that you will know for certain that you have eternal life and that you will go to heaven when you die? This is not something, oftentimes it has been a question actually that people just walk up to people and ask, you know, do you know where you'll spend eternity? If you die, do you know where you will go? But again, if you spent the time investing, a lot of times you can make that withdrawal and have an honest conversation, whereas people on the street oftentimes are going to be offended by that question. And the next question, at what point are you on your spiritual journey? How do you feel about your standing before God? Do you ever wonder about life after death? At times like this, and this would be after some kind of a trial, at times like this, what inner resources do you draw on? I think that's a really good question. You know somebody that's struggling, somebody that is, you know, going through something, whether that be a physical ailment or financial struggle or a death of a family member, you know, asking them a question like this, at times like this, what do you draw on? And they might tell you something, you know, I draw on family, I draw on something, or I don't have anything to draw on. And all of those are awesome doors for you to say, can I tell you what I draw on spiritually? When I'm faced with trials, when I'm faced with struggles, this is what I draw on. And so questions like that open the door. And there's a lot of other questions you can ask, but some different responses to answers. You know, a lot of times people want to ask us questions that are really tough. And the more I read, the more books I look at, I realize that we have an awesome opportunity to ask them questions back. You know, when they give us an answer, we can ask questions like, would you mind explaining that to me? Or why do you say that? Or what do you mean? But in all of these, it needs to have a genuineness behind it, you know? We can't sarcastically be saying things because that ruins our opportunity to really build a conversation. Nothing kills a conversation like a short answer or like a sarcastic answer. And so we ask questions, and there's a lot of other questions that can be asked, and there's a lot of good resources that you can look at. And if you're interested in reading different things about it, I'd love to point you in a direction or two that could help you out on that. But the next point is becoming a part of other people's world. And you know, I found this out it was Friday I went out. You know, it's really hard to get to know people by just going out and knocking on their door. It's really hard to be a part of their world by just knocking on their door once in a while. It takes that investing that we're talking about. And Max Stiles says, exclusive Christian fellowship isolates us from the very people who desperately need Christ. You know, we've been called to be in the world, not of the world, but a lot of us are doing a great job of not being of the world, but not such a great job being in the world. And I know this is one of my biggest downfalls is actually being active in the world. You know, if we aren't a part of other people's world, then why would they listen to what we have to say about Jesus Christ? It's meeting people. It's getting to know them, investing in them, spending time with them. Alvin Reed says, my goal is to see all my neighbors saved. In the meantime, I want to be their friend. But friends don't let friends go to hell. And I think that's important, you know. As we build friendships with people, we can't be content just to be that Christian friend. We have to actually give them the truth. If we truly are friends with them, we truly care about them, then we'll truly care about what happens to them when they die. You know, all of us are going to come to that point where we face death. And in that moment when we die, not very much is going to matter to us. But one of the things that will is whether or not we've witnessed to different people or whether or not they've heard the true story of the gospel. And it reminds me of the parable of the rich man and Lazarus and the idea of send somebody back to tell them. And, you know, he tells them if they didn't listen to the prophets, they didn't listen to Moses, then why would they listen to somebody that we sent, an angel that we sent back to them? But a lot of us haven't engaged our community or our neighbors, even in a way that says they know the message. And this is an area that I know I need to grow in, that I'm trying to take steps towards to grow in, because we have to view people in this way, and we have to want to build a friendship so that we can share the gospel with them because we truly care about them as a person. And so for some of us, and probably some of you, since this is more geared to those of you that live in Hendersonville and not me who lives an hour away, but for some of you, the first step in evangelism is to maybe bake some cookies or something and take them over to your neighbors and say, hello, we are the such and such family, and we've been living here for 2-3 years and have never really introduced ourselves. And we'd like to get to meet you as our neighbors. And for some of you, you've met your neighbors, and it would be a good time to say, hey, I know it's the holiday time and everybody's busy, but we'd love to have you over for a dinner sometime or a game night sometime, and get opportunities to have a relationship building evening. And so you build a relationship so you can begin to share Christ with those that are around you. And once again, a quote that I've used before, and that was on one of the pieces of papers we handed out at the beginning of the series, says, "You cannot win until you begin. So start where you are, disciplined for the glory of God. It is not where you are, but where you are headed that matters." So, you know, maybe you look today and you are doing a pretty good job of reaching your community, and you realize, okay, there's some areas I might be able to step it up. Or maybe you're encouraged in different areas where you feel like you are making steps forward. Or maybe you're sitting here today and you say, you know, I haven't done such a good job of building friendships with the unsaved and getting to know them and communicating Jesus Christ to them. Well, it doesn't really matter which side you're on. It matters what you do from here. It matters where we are going, not where we are in evangelism and in a lot of areas of life. Conversational evangelism practiced by the majority of the members of a church results in a church culture of evangelism, where evangelism is practiced, praised, and prayed for, and where all of this becomes the norm, the product is a healthy, growing church. And in way of closing, I wanted to read an illustration from this book. And, well, it's not really an illustration, it's what really happened. And this church got a group of four people together to be a panel, and they paid them $25 each to sit down with them for an hour and to just discuss different things. And the idea was they would get to know what people were thinking so they could reach them better as a church. And they talked about a lot of different things, and I won't take the time to read all of those things, but they got into, you know, what is truth, and are all religions just the same thing and pointing different ways to the same thing, or, you know, different people had divorced parents, and they brought a lot of different things to the table. And with about 15 minutes left, one person asked a question that wasn't part of the survey that they were given, and the question was, is there anything that would make you want to go to church? There was a long pause. The questioners prompted them, would it make a difference, for example, if the sermons were really good and relevant to your life? They all agreed, not really. Plenty of messages on CD and internet helped them make their life work just fine. Would it make you want to go to church if the music was really hot? It was really good. And they said, not really. There was plenty of great radio stations, and their MP3 players made all kinds of music only a few mouse clicks away. Convenience, relevance, programs, seminars, you name it, whatever enticements were offered to lure them into church were rebuffed with a shrug. Finally, someone tried. Would you go to church if a good friend invited you? Unanimity. All four, without hesitation, emphatically said, yes, we got it. The crowd of Christians collectively remembered a line in the survey, relationships were by far the highest priority of this cohort. Perhaps to fill a vacuum created by a broken marriage or a technological or impersonal society, people want people, not programs, to connect them to God. And I think we're going to see this in our church too. People want people. They don't want programs. They don't necessarily want, you know, relevance. I've read several articles about the fact that people are leaving the church. And one of the reasons they're leaving the church is because the church is trying to be too relevant. And I don't think that is a huge struggle in our church. We're not trying to be overly relevant. But really, as we look at this, we have an opportunity to build friendships, to invest in people, to spend time really getting to know them where they are at and inviting them to see Jesus Christ for who he is. And I'm not even saying that every conversation has to lead to an invite to coming to church. You know, a lot of people are scared off by meeting at a church, but you could have a Bible study with them. A lot of people would be more open to you opening your house and having a Bible study with them. Maybe one or two church families sitting down with a neighbor or a connection in town and saying, this is what the Bible says. And we have the opportunity to build these kinds of relationships. We have the opportunity to say, won't you come see who Jesus Christ is, how he's changed my life. but we do so by investing in the people that we know in our community. We do so by making our lives count, by getting to know the lost, truly loving them, and then showing them who Jesus Christ is. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you so much for the opportunity we have to really just think about how we reach the people around us. I thank you so much that you have given us church members that are engaged with their neighbors, are telling them about Jesus Christ. But I pray that you would help all of us to think this way, that as we walk around town, as we visit stores, we have the opportunity to let our light shine a little bit. And we know that the most effective way is probably not to meet strangers here and there, but even as we walk around during this holiday season, we do have the opportunity to give hope. Whether we're in a grocery store talking to a cashier and just giving them the slight hope of Jesus Christ, or sitting down with a neighbor who's going through different difficulties in their life, we just pray that we would take opportunities to show them who Jesus Christ is. But most of all, Lord, I pray that we would see them through the eyes of Jesus Christ, that as he looked out on the multitudes, he was burdened for them. He had compassion on them, for they were like sheep without a shepherd. And I pray that we would view lost people like this, that we'd have compassion on them, viewing them as people that are lost and needing the good shepherd. And I pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.